You might remember last year, I spoke with Rob Schmitz, the NPR correspondent based in Shanghai. Rob had written a book called The Street of Eternal Happiness, where he wrote about his local neighbours living and working in the former French concession area of Shanghai. In it, and through their stories, he pulled together all the complexities, ironies, and government regulation that dictate either consciously or unconsciously their lives. Well, Rob is in Sydney for the Writers' Festival, and we've welcomed him to the studio not to talk about his book. We'll put a link on our website to the chat we had last year, but this time to discuss his observations of China, which has been so much in the news, and we're also talking about it on Foreign Affair in our second hour, but particularly the stretch of Chinese influence through soft diplomacy. So welcome, Rob.
Geraldine, it's fantastic to be here in person here in Sydney.
This yes, indeed. You've yeah. been, I know you've been sort of learning about the place firsthand.
Yeah.
Look, soft diplomacy is certainly not unique to China. I mean, the Brits, especially through the British Council, I think probably the best in the world.
We Americans are quite good at
it. Yeah, Americans are not bad at it at all, but a little more, I think the Brits are so subtle with it. I think the Americans are a little bit more
We're a little overt, obvious.
But, you know, we could debate that. But I came across a very interesting article recently about the growing discussion in the US about these Confucius Institutes setting up Chinese languages, we have them here, and cultural schools in not only universities, but also in primary schools, I discover, across North America. Now, what's your view about that?
Well, the Confucius Institutes, which are run by the Ministry of Education in China, by this this wing called the Hanban in Chinese, and also from the Propaganda Bureau in China as well, is this network of institutes that provide funding for universities abroad in Australia, in the US, in the EU, for Chinese programs. And it's come under fire, I think, most recently in the United States by a few colleges who basically ejected it because these institutes sometimes will interfere with the curriculum that is being taught at these institutions abroad. And so, for example, in one case, you know, I think that the teachers that are the professors that are hired with funding from the Confucius Institutes sometimes are asked to not talk about controversial topics that would be controversial to Beijing. So topics like Tibet, the relationship with Taiwan, things like Falun Gong, freedom of religion, and things like that. And they're kind of leaned on not to really discuss this or to avoid these topics altogether and put a sort of a happy, rosy portrait of China. And of course, that goes against everything that these universities stand for, the freedom of thought, the freedom of speech, and everything. And it's quite interesting because here you have this Chinese government institution sort of infiltrating free universities abroad.
The funding of these institutes seems to be particularly interesting because the National Association of Scholars in the US says that the fact that universities have a strong financial incentive, particularly at the moment, to host them because significant money comes with them.
Yeah, and that's a really pathetic and sad state of affairs that universities have reached this point where they're so dependent on outside funding that they will take money and actually sign secret contracts with them that are not made public, you know, with these Chinese institutions that are run by the Communist Party of China.
So I just want to go to that question of that it's controlled by the propaganda department, the Central Propaganda Department,
yeah.
And in fact, I think the man who sits at the head of that sits on the Central Committee. I think he's on the Politburo Committee, which is very serious. Now, is this word propaganda the same in both countries? Because that's such a loaded word in the West. You know, from your understanding of China, what does it mean in China?
Well, propaganda is propaganda in China, and they don't mince words about this. It's not subtle, as you mentioned, the Brits are about this. This is literally the Propaganda Bureau of the Communist Party of China, and their mission is to make sure that all information that is disseminated inside of China is approved by the party, and that it portrays the party in in a mostly positive light.
The party or the country?
I would say the party first and also the country. Yeah, because I think when you talk to party members, I don't know how distinguishable those two are.
Is that right? Is that you do get that sense? Because, I mean, obviously, this is what's been very interesting, I think, in Australia. I mean, this happened, for instance, the Sydney Writers' Festival in May of 2011 was trying to bring out a man called Leo Yue, I think is, author and musician from the Sichuan province, which borders Tibet. And he'd spent 4 years in prison. He'd written a big poem called Massacre after Tiananmen. And he basically, they had to disinvite him. They had to uninvite him because there was so much pressure from the Chinese government. And of course, we have this constant debate here about the amount of interest in Chinese diaspora newspapers because we've got such a big Chinese diaspora community. So, I mean, does this filter back? Are you aware of this in China, or is the bigness of the China story simply swallow everything else up?
No, I mean, I think most Chinese, if you're talking about Chinese people, they don't hear about this at all. You know, obviously because of the propaganda department, because you know, news in China is carefully handpicked, and of course the internet in China is censored, and so when news like this comes out, it may appear briefly, but oftentimes it will then be, you know, magically removed by, you know, the cybersecurity czar in Beijing and you know, the millions of people that work there. So I think, you know, information, is quite controlled in China. And so you don't really hear about this that much. And, you know, I didn't even know about that case in Sydney.
He'd made a documentary, I'm just remembering fully, about Rabia Kadir, the Uyghur leader.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And that's disturbing to me.
Can you see a way around it or can you not, whereby now that this is out on the table, that say universities could say to Chinese when the money is being offered, well, look, we have our own absolute strictures here and we won't take it except if we have full control or independence? I mean,
personally, I think that is absolutely what needs to be done. I think that these colleges need to sign a contract where they basically everything is out in the open, where they say, look, these are the rules for this funding. You cannot interfere with our curriculum. You cannot interfere with the teaching at this institution. You're playing by our rules in our country, but we'll accept funding for example, Chinese language instruction, because you know that's the spirit of the relationship, I think, and I think that you know, to have students learn Chinese is a great thing. But to have students then be given the party line at an institution in the U.S. or in the EU and in Australia, that where you have freedom of thought and freedom of speech, I think that crosses some serious lines.
Look, we've discussed before in the program about how China's influenced Hollywood in its depiction of China. But recently, and particularly with Richard Gere's new film coming out, it's very interesting discussion about how China had pressured Hollywood studios not to employ the actor Richard Gere due to his support of Tibet when he made that big statement when he was winning an Oscar. You know, it's not just about the employment of Richard Gere. It's the way apparently China refuses to release any films that Gere appears in. Right. And that's the second biggest box office in the world.
Yeah.
But it is quite a stunning reminder of the growing reach of the Chinese government.
Well, Hollywood right now is very much under the influence of China because it's its biggest growing market for movies. When you look at, you know, movie theaters are being built like you wouldn't believe in China. And so I think, you know, as China's economic power grows, you're going to have more situations like this, especially in industries that are, you know, strictly running from the bottom line. But, you know, when we talk going back to universities, that shouldn't be the case. And that's what disturbs me. It
because
doesn't
it goes
surprise
to
me.
Their core business, exactly. Core mission.
And exactly. And I think it breaks their core mission. And it doesn't surprise me that Hollywood's doing this. I mean, that they're run on money. And so that makes sense to me. And, you know, you could argue about it, but, you know, honestly, it's a business. But when
and
you're
whether
talking,
he should have really used the Oscars as a platform to launch.
You know, honestly, that's all about money. But here, an influence. But here, you know, as when we're talking about institutions of learning, I think that that crosses a serious line.
I wonder if China's One Belt, One Road initiative, or the One Belt Road initiative, I think is actually now properly called out of Mandarin, can be seen in the light of this soft diplomacy. One of our guests in A Foreign Affair coming up said later in the program that he said to us when we were talking to him, that the Indian government sees this as a version of sort of the modern British East India Company. It's sort of like a version of modern colonialism. They actually boycotted the ceremony, I discover. Is that your sense from Beijing? What would that be?
I think One Belt, One Road is just it's a very weird name for a campaign that China was undergoing anyway, which was to export its investment-led growth abroad. So, you know, China's been building things for 30 years, and it's starting to phase it out because a lot of things have been built. You know, they've built high-speed rail, roads, you know, buildings, you know, and everything. So they're trying to export that model because a lot of these companies that do that are state-owned industries. And in order to keep them afloat, One Belt, One Road enables them to go abroad and do this in other developing countries. But I think that makes sense. I mean, I think that that's a fine economic example. I think that every other country, the United States and, you know, UK in the past, have done this as well. And so China's just, you know, China's a big power now, and it's doing what everyone else has done in the past.
And you're back there, are you, at the end of the Writers' Festival?
I'm going back there. I'm going to head up to Queensland for about a week, and then I'm back in China, back in the thick of things.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much, Geraldine. I appreciate it.